Entrepreneurs are so wired to optimism and to the future. Whereas investors, they have the optimism, but they're always trying to ground it in the reality of the data, the things that they can see that have happened that are proven. And it's not in the future because that's unproven and you can't prove that. It's really in the present or in the past.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at Procurement Express. We take the hassle out of managing your company's spend with magical features, but I'm not here to talk about that today. Today, instead, we're going to follow the career journey from someone who's come to finance in a rather unusual route, maybe demonstrating that you don't need to start off in business school in order to be a successful finance leader. And we're going to learn some of the lessons along the way about how he has managed to build his own successful fractional CFO advisory business. So Jason Shapiro from 82i, you're very welcome. How are you today? And tell us a bit about you, your background, and where you are in the world.
Of course. James, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to have this conversation. I am calling from Annapolis, Maryland. I'm based right outside of DC with my wife and two young girls. I got to this point as the founder of 82i, as you mentioned, starting my career actually as a teacher. I had actually done business school in undergrad, but over here in the States, there's a program called the Teach for America program where you can go into teaching from any background, if it's business, medicine, law, whatever. And then go spend 2 years in a low-income school and try to make a difference in what we call the achievement gap between low and high-income education. And so I went into that with the intent to come out the other side and get back into finance. I had a wonderful experience, and I went into it mainly thinking that it would be a good way to do some good in the world. But I come out of it and many years later realize how impactful it was to me in the way that I do business today and in the way that I work with our clients. And I'll get into more of that in a minute. But I left teaching. I went to Wall Street and I spent a handful of years there cutting my teeth and figuring out sort of the nuts and bolts of how finance works and how deals get done. And I worked with really large businesses and learned a lot. I enjoyed that quite a bit. But somewhere along the way, I had the opportunity to work with an entrepreneur, and to sort of put it simply, I just fell in love. I loved the idea of creating businesses, managing quantitative and qualitative problems, sort of navigating through ambiguity in order to optimize strategies and so on and so forth. That's how I saw it then. And so I went back to business school and transitioned away from the large cap private equity investing that I was doing. And transition into earlier stage venture capital investing to sort of stay in the same lane I knew, which was investing, but to do it with an earlier stage target. And I spent a few years doing that. When I was there, my job was to speak to as many founders as I could get on the phone and try to find the ones that would be a good investment for us. And so I spoke to over 1,000 founders in that time frame. And while I was on those calls, I kept hearing sort of the same mistakes happening again and again and again. And the teacher in me was very much like, hey, you should say it this way. Don't say it that way, or focus on this, not that. And I would start to give advice to some of the founders as the investor. And some of them would very much appreciate that. And others would get sort of defensive and sort of dig in and miss the point a little bit. And it made sense because of the position from which I was giving the advice. I was the investor, not the coach. And so I realized I couldn't really do that and still sort of be the investor, because it kind of put our incentives and our situation just didn't make sense at the time. So I spent a few more years there. And then I just realized that after talking to all these folks, I love what they were doing and I wanted to start my own thing and be more like them and less like the investor that I was. And so I jumped ship and joined this effort to start a business called 82i. We are trying to make entrepreneurship easier. And so that is my quick story. And I am looking forward to the conversation.
All right. Well, you said a number of very interesting things there. Let's tick off all the prejudices we have about the different industries you've been through there. So it's very interesting that you would go from assuming the altruistic endeavor, like Teach for America, I'm going to ask about that, and then straight to Wall Street, not known for its altruism, let's put it that way, or not in the popular press anyway. So going for Teach to America, what did you expect and what did you get? Tell us a bit about how it surprised you being part of that program. Why were you even, it seems there's a dissonance here. Why would a Wall Street guy want to do something warm and fuzzy, like make the world better?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I've always had a little bit of that orientation. My younger brother is disabled, and so I spent a lot of time growing up in the disabilities community, and it sort of struck me that Teach for America would be a good way to continue to give back, but also I had hoped to develop a softer set of skills, communication, leadership, poise, et cetera, and so on, that might benefit me later on. And so that's a lot of the reason why I did it, because I could serve both of those two goals for a couple of years early on and then get into the other stuff. And that definitely came true. I think I really learned how to communicate to a large group of people with many different types of listeners, listening for different things. And I think the thing I didn't expect is just how much I would enjoy the relationships with the students, and then over the years getting to see them progress in their careers. I have former students who are now lawyers, who are now, I have one getting a PhD in computer science, and just the relationships that you build as a teacher. I think one thing that I didn't expect was how hard the career of teaching is. It is truly remarkable. People who are able to do that successfully for many years, I could not, but I like to think that I had a positive impact.
Okay, so you gave us another lawyer and another computer scientist. I guess you even things out there a bit.
Yes.
But that's my prejudice, because my old man is a lawyer, so I'm always teasing him about that. But so that's interesting. So if obviously it sounds like you've had a long-term impact, and it sounds like you're still in touch with some of these students in some way. You say you have young kids of your own now. Has that influenced at all how you think about educating your own kids? Or what did you learn from that about the education system and how you're approaching education for your own kids?
Yeah, that's a great question. It very much does. And my kids are 2 and 4 right now. And so we're kind of with the four-year-old just on the cusp of learning letters and those sorts of things. And I think going into teaching, the way I learned and the way I taught myself growing up was very much sort of just grind and focus and put in the time and energy to make it happen. And one of the things I've learned through teaching and managing my team and teaching our clients is you have to teach people at the pace they're willing to learn. Everyone has a different capacity for growth. And so if you're trying to grind the way that I did with someone who doesn't have that same orientation to learning, not only will you fail, but you'll ruin the relationship. And so one of the lessons that I've had with clients and with my kids when we're teaching them letters all the same is to really listen and understand where that learner is and then adapt.
Interesting. Yeah. Like when I started this journey with the podcast, I think I've interviewed maybe almost 100 CFOs, professional CFOs at this stage. And I expected them to be kind of like me, like a nerd, but with a calculator, to be very analytical and so on. And that may be true. But actually what I've noticed is the most successful people in this field are far closer to diplomats or communicators than they are, you know, number crunchers, let's put it that way. And that's the successful ones certainly seem to be able to, it's far more about communication than it is about the technical side of the work.
100%. I completely agree with that. And I kind of think of it as three levels almost. It's sort of the base level in order to do this work as a finance lead. You have to understand the numbers. It's quantitative. Everybody knows that. And if you can't do that, you really probably can't be in the role. The next level higher is being able to connect that quantitative side to the qualitative side and sort of let the numbers tell the story of the strategy. and let the strategy be supported by the numbers, sort of that iterative mutual support concept. And then at the highest level, to your point, it's communicating and managing the various stakeholders that come into contact with those numbers. And I think it's a pyramid. There's the most people are able to do that lower stuff. Fewer people are able to do the qualitative and the quantitative, and the fewest are able to do all of that and communicate it on top.
Okay. So let's move on to the, I'm going to talk rather selfishly about your, what I would call outreach to looking for investments, because this is something I have personal experience with all the time. I get calls, I do calls all the time with different firms, and I'm interested about the mistakes I'm making when I'm talking with. So what are the common mistakes and a business owner or entrepreneur or someone like me might make when they take a call like that? What's the most common? You mentioned a couple of common mistakes there. So what are they?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, there are many. There's a lot of different ways that folks can go wrong. One of the analogies that I like to say about raising capital is that it's similar to the old book or phrase, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. I think entrepreneurs and investors just fundamentally speak different languages. And a lot of what happens is that, you know, those two folks are just speaking differently and focusing on different things. So one major mistake that I see a lot of from founders is that they are naturally wired to be optimists. You kind of have to be if you're in this role, because if you're not optimistic about your prospects, then what are you doing? Because it really probably, you won't be able to stay sane. Yeah. And so entrepreneurs are so wired to optimism and to the future. Whereas investors, they have the optimism, but they're always trying to ground it in the reality of the data, the things that they can see that have happened that are proven. And it's not in the future, because that's unproven and you can't prove that. It's really in the present or in the past. And so that dichotomy and difference can lead to a lot of miscommunications, where a founder can spend the whole pitch talking about all the marvelous things that are going to happen in the future, when really all the investor needs to know at that point is like, well, what are your numbers? How have things gone? What have you done? And so that's a big one I see a lot.
So if you were to condense them, like when we talk, let's talk about those numbers that you should have ready as a founder, or even as a, let's say on a finance team, and you're taking a call with a potential investors, like how can you, what's the most high bandwidth version of that call you can do for the investor? What do they really want to know most?
Yeah, well, oftentimes it depends. Well, it depends on how far along you are in the conversation. So investors get dozens of emails every day from founders trying to raise capital. They have probably a handful of calls every day. And over the course of the year, just like I said earlier, they're talking to thousands of people. And so what they're trying to do is quickly understand on that call, really as quickly as they can, is this company even in the ballpark of what I'm looking for? Right. And the quickest, most efficient way to know that is to just ask what's revenue, what's growth, are you profitable, how much capital have you raised, what's your retention if you're a SaaS company, and those high level metrics, either they're gonna fit the mandate that the investor has or they're not. If they do fit, then they'll probably go deeper and try to understand the product and the market and so on and so forth. And then if they understand that and feel good about it, then they'll go deeper. And eventually they'll want to hear about that futuristic story that the founder wants to talk about, because it is relevant to them, but they want to hear about it a few steps later. If the numbers don't fit though, it's probably no point in either side staying on the call, because investors are very focused on exactly what they're able to do and exactly what they're looking for. And remember, they see thousands of businesses. And so it doesn't make sense for them to stand on the call, but often they do to be polite, because you don't want to hang up. But it's sort of that degree. And founders, sometimes another mistake they make is they can understand they're not a fit, but then try to sell their way into being a fit. Well, we're not yet at 7 million of revenue. I know that's your minimum, but you know, I'm at 5, but I'm definitely going to be at 7. Like, are you sure? And let me tell you all the reasons why I'm going to be at 7 soon. That kind of thing.
Yeah, because like on the other side of those conversations, I mean, throughout my career, pretty much in Procurement Express, definitely I've been having them. And sometimes it's hard not to feel, at the beginning, now I think listening to you, I'm understanding more. But at the beginning, I definitely felt like, well, hold on, this guy is coming in, guy or girl, they appear to be quite junior. It seems to be often the first touch is with a junior associate, maybe someone straight out of college, or and then they ask you all these personal business questions, like what's your margin and what's your growth rate and how do you acquire customers? And it feels very weird to be talking about that stuff. But now later on, when I come to these conversations, I learned that you're, like you're saying, I just say, listen, these are our numbers, whatever, a couple of million revenue, this rate, growth rate, this margin, what numbers are you looking for? And then within a couple of minutes, you can kind of, you can understand. And I used to be offended, quasi-offended if people weren't interested. But then I've come to realize that there's different stage funds. Like there's people who might want to write a $5 million check and they wouldn't want to write bigger than that. And there's other people who wouldn't write anything less than 20. And it's not that a question of one's right or one's wrong. It's just their fund size, how much they can put into any one investment, all backs into what sort of check size they can write. And that's totally, it's much more about that fund's criteria than it is me and how good or beautiful my business is, right? Which is hard to parse apart when you're the father of your baby business. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's a really good example. It founders can sometimes sort of take that personally or think that it's a sign of the quality of their business or their story, and it's not. It really is just, what is that fund focused on, and do you fit it? And one of the things that I tell founders a lot is 9 out of 10 times you can find out what the fund is focused on from the internet on their website, because a lot of times they'll tell you. Yeah. And so you can know if it's worth taking the call or not. One major mistake, I think this is a major mistake because it has implications on the business, is that founders can take a lot of time on these calls. I mean, I've talked to founders that have 400 calls with investors. That's a lot of time that could be spent building product, selling, managing your team, doing all the things that really drive value. Yeah. And of those 400, how many of those investors actually were good fits? It's often a much lower number. And so I recommend that folks only take the calls when they know it's a good fit. And there's an argument to be made that you should try to build relationships with folks over time. Investors love it when you talk to them when you're a little bit too early. You say, hey, your minimum is 5. I'm at 3. I'm going to be there in a year. And then a year later, you're actually at 5 and you're a good fit. That's a really good sort of power move that will put you in a good position from a negotiating standpoint. But I don't think there's so many investors that fit the exact thing that folks are doing that you should do that with any more than 10 folks or 15 folks. And that's because investing ultimately, like, or raising capital ultimately, it can be a bit of a commodity. You need the money. But really what you need is product and customers.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been in angel forums, investment forums, and I've heard other angels describe how they're sick of all the selling. I just really want to know, is this a real opportunity? And there is a culture with startup schools and incubators, et cetera, which is basically gaming one another. These are the things you need to say, and this you need to be selling. And of course, you got to sell. There's nothing wrong with selling. But at the end of the day, you want a good partner. You want the right partner. You only get married once or twice, depending on where you are. Yeah, but you want to get married to the right person. And it's much more about that fit. Let me just ask you one more question on this, because it's something I've been doing, and maybe it's a bit gauche, but you can tell me, which is just to put an investor relations section on our website and then allow people to say, just log in and say, now give me your email. And maybe two or three questions like, what sort of check size do you look for? What sort of growth do you look for? And then we'll send you an up-to-date data sheet with all the numbers you might want. We can kind of skip the call, both of us, either way. And then if you want to talk after that, do you think that's a halfway house? Because you then I get to see who has the data sheet. We don't need to spend 15 minutes or half an hour in a call just to get that initial ballpark, and we can both move on quicker and do something else.
Yeah, it's a great concept. I like this. When I was an investor, I remember there was one company where I reached out to them on email, which was usually how we first initiated contact. they responded with a Word document questionnaire for us. And this was the first time I had ever seen anyone do this, that said, what's your funds focus? What's your revenue target? What's your check size? What do you look for? And then a brilliant question of who are your competitors? And so it was a very smart move on behalf of this founder, because it signals that they know their value, they know that they are valuable, and it made me much more interested in wanting to talk to them, presuming that they probably are a good business. And if there was a match, that they'd be a good fit. But it showed value, but it also benefited that founder, because then they immediately know who are the other funds that I need to go out to that also fit. And that creates what is the best thing you can do in a competitive capital raise from the seed of the founder, which is create that competitive tension. You'll get the best valuation, you'll get the best match, because you'll have talked to all the folks, but also, to your point, you're doing it in a minimum amount of time. Now, the one thing that I'd caution, we talk about investability a lot in some of our content and materials. If you do that when you have low investability or you're not investable, then it can kind of backfire, because you sort of look silly if you're sort of playing a more powerful sort of move like that, but you're not, your numbers aren't quite good enough for investment. That is can be a tricky balance. But anyway, there's lots of puts and takes in here, but it's one of the dynamics to think about as well, as this investability point.
Okay, well, maybe, I don't know if we're investable or not, but maybe I'll do it anyway, because what it bears on my mind, like over the years, has been, I don't know, I don't want to say, probably up to 100 calls. And now it wasn't right then for on either side, but at some stage it might be right for me. And I want to be able to go back and say, okay, who actually is right now? Now that we're 20% or double or triple what we were back then, like, well, where are we now? And then who should I talk to? Because right now I'm into diving into my email inbox and trying to remember people's names, and it never works. So
yeah. So. Yeah. One of the things that we always recommend folks do is create a little investor database Excel sheet of who all the people are, when you spoke to them, what their targets are, yeah, all that. Because it can take time, and you may talk to someone 1 year and not do a deal for 3 years later, and you need a little CRM for it, basically.
Okay, so let's move on to your own entrepreneurial journey. You liked working with founders, and you wanted to work more with them. So tell us about ED2Y. You make the audacious claim of we're on the mission to make entrepreneurs' life easier. If I can read it just behind you there. So that's a broad claim. So tell us about how you came to get started. Did you do it by yourself? Who was your first client?
Yeah, of course. So I was investing, and when I left, like I said, I wanted to start a business. And over time, I had collected a whole bunch of ideas for what that business would be. There were 82 of them. 82i stands for 82 ideas. Not about me, but more about founders who just have lots of ideas. That's our core demographic. And so I had an 82 idea list long of things I'd do. And then I was planning to consult with founders on the side to pay the bills. And when I told folks about that, I got a lot of interest on that side. And so I sort of said, well, if I'm trying to start something and I see a lot of demand for something, I should see if I can turn that into a business. And so that was my initial hypothesis, is let's see if this can be a scalable business that would be more than just the 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week that I'm going to work. And I very quickly got conviction in that. And the thesis then was that let's try to find a way to make entrepreneurship easier, exactly like our tagline is. And we experimented with a lot of different things and sort of threw a bunch of stuff on the walls to see what stuck. And ultimately what we came down to is that the hourly rate is not just a simple pricing model with a simple hourly rate is underutilized in the ecosystem of really high quality service providers. A lot of service providers focus on using retainers, because then they can lock in that recurring revenue. or they want a success fee in the example of a broker or an investment banker so that they can make a lot of upside if they help someone raise capital or whatever. Mm. And in both of those cases, the incentives are really misaligned with the founder. In the retainer case, the provider wants to deliver the services with as little time as possible, and they want to just keep the account open, which isn't always value aligned. If you're trying to minimize your time, you're not over-delivering. You're not really incentivized to do that on a consistent basis. And then in the success fee case, you're only incentivized to do some particular objective. And sometimes that's good, but other times it prevents you from having an honest conversation of, is it the right time to raise capital? Or if you're not likely to be successful, you wouldn't really get that person's full attention. And so it created all these issues that ultimately just hurt the cash-strapped entrepreneur, who all the while is sort of running on a business, on a budget, and trying to make do with a lot of different things. And so we said, okay, let's just do an hourly rate. Let's track every minute that we spend, and then let's show a detailed report to our client every week. And oh, importantly, let's not require them to stick with us. Let's put the onus on us as a business to constantly be proving our value to the founder. And so what happened is that we would go in and folks would say, sure, like go try to solve this thing over there and let us know how long that takes and we'll pay you. And we'd solve a problem. And then, as you probably know, founders have hundreds of problems, and we'd get pulled into, you know, more problem areas. And so our first major client was a company called Seven Mindsets that was looking to set up a data room initially for a transaction. They were thinking about selling the business. We did the data room, and then they brought us in to sort of ride sidecar with this founder on every call, negotiation, and so forth through to closing. We got very close with that business, helped them sell to private equity. And then we stayed on as their CFO because they didn't have a finance team in-house. Well, they had a controller, but not a CFO. And after that transaction, we had gotten to know the business so well that it just made logical sense for us to stay on. And we stayed there for about 18 months as their CFO. And so that's a good example of like how our model works and why it works, and ultimately how we think that makes entrepreneurship easier for founders, because we're taking things off their plate in a way that just works for them. They pay only what they want. And if they're not seeing the value, they don't have to continue.
Okay. So if any of my buddies come to me asking for a new business they want to start, and they tell me I'm going to target entrepreneurs, I always tell them, well, yeah, why would you want to market where 50% of them statistically are going to be out of business in 18 months? It sounds like a really tough. So how do you go about finding, because entrepreneurs are crazy. I can card carrying here, so I can admit this, right? So they're, and the best of us are even crazier, right? It seems to me like if I meet like some, I'll call out to Robert Hartline here. He's been on the podcast. He gave us a great story previously about how he was embezzled for $300K on the podcast by his bookkeeper, and as it happens, and how he got the money back, which is quite interesting. So go look at that if you want to find out about that. But anyway, Robert, I love him to bits. Totally crazy. A mile a minute, new business idea every time. I was in a mastermind with him, literally every month there was a new business going. That guy has more businesses. And the thing is, you know what? On the outside, you would think it's pure craziness. That can never work. He's extremely successful. So how do you go? And then I know other crazy people who are just crazy and get nowhere. So how do you go about picking the people you need to invest your time in? Because you can't afford to be your customers to be out of business every 16 months. How do you go about finding those people that are going to be a good fit for you, not to pretend?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Entrepreneurs can be crazy, and that's part of the fun of it. One way I think about this is back to the teaching point. Our goal is to make entrepreneurship easier for all founders, and to teach them in the way that they need, or to support them in the way that they need. If you have the sort of mile a minute founder persona, which is very common, you got to first keep up with that person. But probably where they're struggling is communicating with investors or their team, because they're idea people. They're all over the place. They have brilliant ideas, but it can be hard for other people to follow them. And so when we've had clients with that persona, we step in, we structure what they're doing, and we put it in a system that makes it easier for folks to understand. And that helps them because they don't have to waste so much time trying to get everybody to keep up with them. They can go off and think about those things and drive value and make sales and do X, Y, Z. And so that's how we handle that sort of persona. I think to your point of how do you work with a client that goes out of business every 18 months, I think there's a couple elements to it. Like one, we have a pretty strict collections policy. Like it can be harder sometimes to collect from founders. But the way we do it is that we bill weekly. And if we don't get paid in a certain window, we just have to pause until we do get paid. And then we pick right back up. And so we don't get caught on that ever. But that's one way that we sort of defend ourselves. But I'd say, like, even for the founder that does one business and 18 months later, they're in another business, doesn't really affect us, because if we're doing our job and if we're adding value to that founder and making an impact on their objectives, they're probably going to want us again when they go to that next venture for some other thing. And so I think we found a way to align our incentives and interests with these customers. And the more value that we can give to them, the better we can enable them, the more they need us. And so it feels like a good market to us, but we know that traditionally it hasn't been a great one for service providers. And that's part of the reason we're chasing it.
Right. Okay. That's counterintuitive there. It's a bad market, but that's why you're chasing it. But I guess you're making it work. So, Anna, how is it going? How have you're obviously working yourself on this. I know that you have a team. How about scaling this hourly model? Is that like a partnership model then internally, or?
Yeah. It's going great. So it's traditionally a harder market, but I think the hourly rate and sort of how we're doing this is making it does work. We've scaled. We've got a little more than 20 people on the team. We've had 88 clients to date, many of whom have stuck with us for over a year. And it's, when I say it's harder, it's kind of like, I like to think of it as like running with a weight vest. We're intentionally sort of pushing ourselves to be in the most challenging situations. And if we can keep up with the founders, like your friend, we can keep up with anyone. And it allows us to do more, see more, and make more impact. So we really like that challenge. But from a inside the business perspective, it's a partnership model. So we call our offering co-founder for hire, which is sort of a big term. But the idea is that your co-founder is someone that sees the business cross-functionally in the same way you do. They can go from area to area and solve the really hard problems with you. And we think we're good enough to be able to come in, quickly learn our client's business and be able to impact on that level. And so the way that we do that is that we've got a pretty intricate internal system for how we intake information and learn the businesses that we work with. We have to make sure that we can come in and a day or two later with the data that we need, understand the business in the way that the founder does and in the way that they need. And so we do that, and that process works very well. We also have partners who are experts in different areas. So I started, as I mentioned, with the capital raise and then CFO, and I've since done a handful of other things, but that's sort of where I started. We've since hired another person, Andrew Boyd, in charge of transaction services. And before him, we had someone, Kevin Spector, who's in charge of revenue, which is sales and marketing. And we've dabbled a little bit in product and operations and a few other areas, and I anticipate that we'll build that out more over time. But yeah, that's the idea. It's a partnership model. Every project is staffed with a team. It's not just the partner. It's a partner and an engagement manager who is on the partnership track. And so we're able to sort of distribute our time and maintain the same level of quality of impact.
Okay. So penultimate question then here, which is, let's say you are doing fractional work. If you think back when you started with your first client, you're someone who's doing some fractional work. Maybe you still have a full-time gig and you're doing nights and weekends, but you've almost got enough work to go full-time as a fractional CFO. How do you take that next step to not just buy yourself a job, but like, what would you advise that person to turn that just basically a consultancy gig into a real business where you can start to scale to your employee 1, 2, and 3?
It's a great, with the question you're asking, I think just to clarify is what would we advise to an individual practitioner in the fractional space?
Yeah, someone who wants to become a fractional CFO and maybe build a fractional firm, like should they give you a call and become a partner or should they, or what would you say would be the way to build a fractional firm, not just of one person, but to a larger scale?
Oh yeah. I mean, I think our model is the best model to do that. I mean, it's not just marketing. I think initially when I heard your question, I was thinking, well, fundamentally, I think it's challenging to be an individual practitioner, fractional CFO, because in addition to serving your clients, you've got to have a marketing engine and you've got to be able to generate future clients and you've got to manage all the administration of what you're doing and your finances and you've got to potentially hire and you've got to do all these different things that you end up being really stretched and you end up only being able to bill a fraction of the time that you're working. And so our model allows folks to come in as partners and lead and sell projects, but with all that stuff taken care of. So we have a team of, I think, 11 or 12 now in the Philippines they're a core part of our team. We had an offsite over in Manila a couple of months ago, and they support us with all that. So the hourly billing model is very time intensive from an operational complexity standpoint, having approvals every week for every little time entry that we spent during a week. Sending that off to the client, explaining it, updating them, takes a lot of time. They help us with that. And what it means is that a partner gets the benefits of the hourly model that I just described. But all they have to do really is look at the hours one time, approve them, and then send an email to the client every week. And so it's very, very manageable from that perspective. At the same time, we have folks helping us with sales and we're out. All we have to do is sort of hop on a sales call that gets queued up for us and meet a founder, which is the fun of the job. And so I think our model allows folks to do that in a way that's sustainable and like I said, optimizing for the fun stuff.
Okay, so this leads me to my final question of the podcast, which is, do you have a business hero and who is it?
Yeah, you said you were gonna ask this question. I thought about it a good bit. I went back and forth on a few people, but Bezos is the one that I really admire. I think the thing that I most commonly hear and read him saying is to focus on the customer, which is such an obvious piece of advice for business. But I see so many people forget that. They get pulled into raising capital or they get pulled into the product or building the right system or whatever. And all that matters is customer, keeping them happy, and doing everything, I think he calls it relentlessly, to sort of make that customer happy. And so that's the piece of advice that I hear him give that I really like and I try to come back to. But then pretty much literally every other thing that I've read from him, I also find incredibly compelling I try to incorporate into the business. So he's my business hero.
Yeah, there's two interviews I've seen with him. One is like a 1999, really Yankee start of Amazon with a full head of hair. And then more recently in 2023, I think he was interviewed on the Lex Fridman podcast and he was totally transformed. Like obviously totally different person many years later, but you got a real sense for that guy. He's one of these billionaires that Elon Musk is everywhere. You can't get on YouTube without seeing him, but there's actually, you don't see a lot from him in person. And I find it very interesting to... You're so charming. I didn't expect him to be charming, but he was super at that laid back, chill vibe. He described how he got up in the morning and he just putters around the place. He's not one of these like 4 o'clock in the morning doing push-ups in an ice bath type of stuff. But he went, I get up and I putter and then I do my meetings. But he has this reputation as this fearsome beast. So I was surprised to hear that about him. Okay. Well, if you are still listening to the podcast, congratulations. You've earned the right to join our newsletter. Very select few people get to do that. You can go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter and you can sign up. You'll get updates every time we drop a new podcast just like this, as long as up-to-date industry news. We recommend software tools that might be useful to you in the business. So I'd recommend you sign up for that. Jason, this has been super interesting. I've really enjoyed our chat and thank you very much for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.